All right, it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I'm one of your co-hosts. I'm here with my fellow co-host, Mr. Neil Dewing. How are you?
Oh, fair to middling, Jay. How about yourself?
Doing pretty well. Doing pretty well. As we say all the time when we start this show, we ask if you guys are out there listening, if you enjoy it, you know, please subscribe. But also, you know, if you could take a mosey on over to iTunes and leave us a rating, leave us a review. We want to know what you think. And
yes, we do. We absolutely require it. Honestly, I'm a little disappointed that more of you haven't complimented us recently. So even if you've complimented us once before, please leave us a comment. We do appreciate it, and we learn from it.
We absolutely do. All right.
Yeah. So Jay, have you ever done any acting in your life?
I have one credit to my acting resume. I played a character named Chick Clark in a high school production of My Sister Eileen.
That was
the extent of my acting chops. You know,
aside from a little community theater when I was younger, I basically my only acting gig right now is acting like I know what I'm doing every day.
Yeah, that works. You're good at
like
it.
I know, right? Like I know what I'm talking about. But we have a real actor with us this evening.
Yes. Yes, and we are excited to have him. If anybody's out there is listening, if you're a friend, if you're a fan of The Americans, if you're a fan of the Showtime show Billions, if you're a fan of House of Cards, he's on all three of those shows. Kelly O'Coin is here with us today. How are you, sir?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you very much. What was the name of that play that you said you did?
My Sister Eileen.
The coast to coast hit.
Yeah, the coast to coast hit. You know, it's funny. I still remember. The role was like of a reporter, and my drama teacher had said, you know, he's on the make. Was like one of the things that he had to do.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
How old were you?
I was 17.
Oh, it's perfect.
It was great. I got to go on stage. Like I played like a drunk, so I got to go on stage and like burp, you know, and stuff like that in front of everybody. It was fun.
Nice.
What 17-year-old guy isn't on the make?
I know, right? That's kind of easy. Well, Kelly, we appreciate you taking the time to hang out with us here.
Sure. Thanks for asking me.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of The Americans. I'm a big fan of Billions. You know, I'm looking forward to the second season. So that should be fun.
Yes. Yeah, we're actually Americans doesn't start shooting until October, but we are just about finished. I think we're at the halfway point. We start episode 7 next week.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. And then, you know, The Americans, which is, you know, the season just kind of wrapped up about a month ago, I think, right? Or maybe a month and a half ago.
March, actually.
Oh, was it March? See,
I know,
I can't even keep track of time. I don't know how you do it.
It's been a busy summer.
I was looking at your, you know, like, you know, your credits, and it's like TV and film and theater and everything like that. I don't know how you find any downtime with all the work that you do. Kind of, you know, let's, you have all the work that you've done, there's a lot of stuff there. So why don't you kind of take a few minutes and kind of tell us, you know, how you started out, you know, what made you want to be an actor? What was like the first big role that you got, all that kind of good stuff, so that everybody can kind of get a sense of who you are.
Okay. I figured out I wanted to be an actor from a really early age, actually. My dad was in politics, which probably had something to do with it. Just something about being, from an early age, being comfortable in front of people, you know, and seeing someone who had to also deliver in front of crowds. So I'm sure that that had, I've always said it has, and I think it must have had something to do with it. And my mom was a singer. She didn't do it professionally, but she was a singer, and she did sing in front of people periodically as well. And so she got us singing. And when we were really young, we were lucky to have to go to schools that had choruses, you know, and so we would learn elaborate music and perform it in front of people and get up for any of you who have performed, you know that there's that sort of what do you call it? There's a tingle that happens when something's going well on stage. There's this synthesis. There's this, you know, you're breathing the same air as the audience, and everyone's affecting the performance, even if they're not actually performing. Mm-hmm. There was some understanding of that as at an early age, and so I was sort of hooked. And from those early chorus groups, I think it was even in fourth grade, one of the heads of the chorus wrote a play called The Trial of Mother Goose, and had lots of parts so lots of kids could sing, but the lead role was Old Cole, and Old King Cole was putting Mother Goose on trial for defamation of character on behalf of the...
That doesn't sound like something a merry old soul would do.
well played, sir. And I got cast as Old King Cole. So, and I remember the first time I did something that was off script, a little improv thing. I didn't even know the word improv at the time, but I just did something that I thought was funny. And the crowd laughed. And I was like, oh, this is good. And from there, honestly, it was, I did musicals through fifth, sixth, seventh grade. I got into junior high, and I was lucky enough, in Sisters, Oregon, small rural Oregon, to have a guy who, he was an English teacher, and he put on plays and cast me in plays, and they were fairly rigorous for that age. And, you know, the bug was fed, and it's grown from there. When I went to high school in Washington, D.C., again, there was a great theater department, and there were a lot of people creating their own work. It wasn't just teachers and faculty in charge of everything. We were all empowered to, I started up building sets, and the student directed one act, and we would... we would do plays that other students had written. So, you know, you get empowered. And in college, I went to a place called Oberlin in Ohio, which also had sort of a similar kind of structure. There were great teachers. It was a lot to learn from them. Mm-hmm. But we learned from each other. You know, we built our plays from the ground up. And then, stop me if I'm going on too long, but then I went to New York because I was going to become famous. And I waited tables for about a year. And I think I went on exactly one audition, which I didn't get. And then I left New York because it was too much. The rejection was too much. And I drove, I had a Volkswagen bus at the time. I drove around the country. The idea was I was going to drop resumes and headshots off at different theaters around the country. And I ran out of money in Portland, Oregon, which is where we're originally from. And where my parents still had a place. So I worked in a steel mill for a month so I could get enough money to come back. And in the interim, I saw some audition notices and auditioned for this Sam Shepard play and got in. And that was my first professional play. I was there for a couple of years, and then I went down to Los Angeles, where my wife had moved once she graduated from college. She was girlfriend at the time.
It was starting her dance career. And which she thought was just going to be a year or so. And she remembers this very clearly. She told me she was going to maybe give it a... She was a great dancer in college, but she was going to be a physical therapist and would give dance a year and just sort of play with it. And she remembers me sort of scoffing and saying, you're way too good for that. This, you shouldn't try to make this a career. And for better and for worse, she did. And she's been very successful for the last 20 plus years. But hopefully she won't curse me for leading her down the path of the one career that would possibly make less money than a theater actor. But anyway, so I went to LA and I did, just like New York, of course, you're going to the big city. It was like in the back of my brain, I wasn't shouting it to anybody, but in the back of my brain, I thought, yeah, now's my time. I'm going to be famous. And again, I waited tables and catered. And I actually... One gig that seemed like a good idea at the time turned out to be probably not the best for the confidence of the psyche was I started working for a company that catered for films on film sets. So I was setting up meals for the extras and helping cook things for people during the, you know, the lunch breaks and everything. And I thought it would be great because I'd be closer to what I ultimately wanted to do, where I ultimately wanted to be working. But it ended up being really depressing. You know, not only am I not, this is terrible. And I'm not denigrating the job at all. It was money. It was good, honest work.
But it wasn't what you wanted to do. Yeah.
Right. Because of my circumstance, it felt like I was not only not doing that stuff, I was serving the people who are doing that stuff. And they look at me like a caterer. And I wasn't high on the rung. I wasn't very far up the rung, up the ladder. I was on a low rung. So I was the guy cleaning the dishes, you know. So that was L.A. for me. And at that point, somewhere at a particularly low point, I got a call from the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, who I had auditioned for about 7 or 8 months before, when I was in, when I was still up in Portland, and they asked if I wanted to join the season. And my initial thought was, well, I can't, because I just came down to be with my girlfriend, and we really want to try to make a go of this. And then my second thought was, oh God, I've got to do this. And bless her, my wife Carolyn, I'm just going to stop qualifying it. She's my wife now, so know that we got married sometime later. She said, you got to go. And so I spent 2 seasons with the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, which felt very much like my grad school. The first season I understudied, I think I remember it was 9 roles, and played very small parts. And just watching these amazing people every night, and I had to see the show every week, and we would have put in rehearsals, so I would have to go through the machinations of the role, if not do it in front of an audience. And then the second season, I got some nice roles. And I decided not to come back for a third season. I went back to L.A. once again, thinking, now this is my time. And also to be with Carolyn. And again, it was not my time. I catered and waited tables and was all basically depressed. And that was when Carolyn decided she was going to pursue dance in New York. And I decided to go with her. And it was a great decision, because slowly I started getting work. I mean, theater was my base. And so to start off in a town like New York, where you know, there is TV and film, especially now, there's tons of TV. But even then, there was TV and film, but it was a theater base, and you could do a small play, and people would... Can I swear on the show?
Yep.
Just, okay. But you could do a small play, and people would give a shit. cast directors would come, producers, TV directors would come, playwrights ended up writing on TV, you know, and they would go back and forth. And so it was more one community. It wasn't an either-or thing. And then it was very slow for me, but I remember talking to my family about it one time, just every year, literally, even if something felt, even if the end of the year felt sparse, I would look back on every year. Each year there was growth. So it was a tortoise. I was definitely the tortoise. And about 5 years ago, something changed, and I started booking gigs, TV gigs. I got, I played this crazy villain on a TV show called Unforgettable. I don't think I was particularly good, but it was like a big guest starring role, and people started to, that mattered on the resume, and maybe people saw it. And I got the Americans gig, and right after that, I got the House of Cards gig. The Americans gig actually ended up, I didn't know it was going to be recurring. And interesting little side note, the wig master, Peg, the woman who's in charge of all the wigs on that show, said in an interview, so I'm not giving anything away, said that she never would have put me in that wig if she'd known I wasn't going to be just a one-off.
Oh, okay.
No one told her I was a possible recurring character. She's like... She said, I cringe every time I see it.
That's
yeah,
great.
And from that, I booked the next, I guess, 2 years into the Americans, not long after House of Cards. House of Cards had not aired yet, but it was on my resume. And I remember walking into the audition for Billions, and they all were asking, so wait a minute, who are you playing? And there was interest, you know? And I'm sure that just put me a little bit more on the forefront of their brain. Because if you've seen Pilot of Billions, Dollar Bill doesn't say a whole lot.
Right.
A lot of people could have played that role. I'm glad it was me, and we've turned it into something over the course of the first season.
Absolutely.
But at the time, they didn't know what they were going to do with it. And so, you know, things started to all happen right at the same time. And in some ways, I wish they'd happened earlier. It would have been nice. But it's not so bad to, you know, be in your 40s instead of your 20s or 30s when success starts to happen. Success in quotes. I have to. I have to put it in quotes.
I think... it is a good success story, because a lot of people who do go down that route, they never get past the waiting tables and catering. They give up and they go back and do something different. But it seems to me from your story that at every point along the road there, you had support systems, you had supportive family members, you had theater programs in school, active theater programs. Do you remember like a little bit more about those kind of early years, about especially in school, those kind of programs? I remember my own high school sort of it was kind of out in the country, and so there was not a lot of high culture going on there, and the theater program was, I'll say, dormant. it sort of resurrected after I left, which is kind of a shame, because I did have an interest in it. But yeah, so I never had access to those kind of, you know, English teachers putting on plays and that sort of thing. It was just not there. Do you credit that with any of your development and your success?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It was... I know it's a cliche. People always talk about, I was such an awkward kid, and I found my family in the theater department. And I wouldn't say that was exactly me. I don't think I was a particularly awkward kid. I also played basketball, and I did have a lot of friends. But there was something about that specific community in high school and before that, the junior high and grade school, that was just, there was something more open about it. And it must be connected to that tingle I was talking about that you feel when you're connected to an audience. I think that there's gotta be a connection. It's just something in the way people who want to create, I might get goofy sounding, but people who care about people who care about creating things are, generally speaking, at least they were in my experience, they were open people. They were open to you, they were open to whatever odd qualities you had, and they accepted them and they found them interesting as opposed to bizarre and off-putting. So I think that had something to do with it, just in terms of the communities created. And I was lucky to have schools that cared about the arts, schools that cared about creating a place for the arts and creativity to happen. I also think it was good. Like, none of the schools I had, when I got to college, I was shocked at how, amazing the facilities were. And this is, I mean, in Oberlin, it's not, the facilities weren't that great, but it was just more than what I was used to. My schools were always sort of smaller, scrappy schools. But what I loved about that was that it put a lot of the onus on us as students to create things and to, you know, we weren't just acting in the plays, we were building the sets and we were designing them with the help of some wonderful teachers. Who oversaw us, and they're not going to give you a handsaw if they're not overseeing you, or a buzzsaw.
Right, right.
But there was, so it was a nice mix. It was, they taught us to fish. They didn't give us fish.
I don't build sets anymore, but I have an appreciation for it. But I do think that that was the kind of thing that gave me ownership of it, and it felt more like a lifestyle as opposed to, oh, I like doing plays.
I know exactly what you mean. I was fortunate enough, even though my school didn't have a theater program going, our local community theater was very active, still is. It's been going strong for, I think, 55 years now, so they're doing pretty good.
And where is this?
I was in Smithfield, Virginia, which you may recognize if you are a consumer of pork products. Smithfield ham.
Smithfield ham.
But so this community theater, it was in an old cotton gin. And so, you know, very cramped, little old warehouse, you know, from the 1800s, that sort of thing that had been repurposed. And so that spirit of creativity was very present, you know, very active, involved group of individuals there. And that sense of belonging that you mentioned, that sense of finding a family, it really is a thing. Because I remember feeling like, okay, I can be a little weird with these people because they're theater people. And it makes perfect sense.
They certainly tolerate, and they certainly seem to enjoy it. I remember that same kind of feeling. It's how old were you at that point?
I was 16 or 17. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's such a great, such a amazing time to actually have some affirmation that these weirdnesses, these quirks of yours are not, they don't have to be stifled, at least not all the time.
So, Kelly, your father was a member of Congress for 16 years, I think it was, maybe a little longer.
18 years.
Okay. So the question, of course, we have to ask is, has your dad seen House of Cards? Has he seen it? Has he watched it? and if so, you know, what has he said about, you know, how overly dramatic it is, or realistic, or whatever? Has he seen it, and has he said anything, or no?
Yeah, my mom and dad have opinions. I think my mom tolerates it less than my dad. They like it. They like it quite a bit. I honestly can say that I think they liked my four episodes better than any other episode. Seriously.
Of course.
Can't imagine why. Yeah, I mean, they think it's a little over the top. Maybe they wouldn't say little. And it's sort of like the finance people that I see in my neighborhood or at the gym, who are all like, "Hey, dollar bill," and they want to talk about the show, and they're like, "Well, that never happens that way." But oh my God, I love it! You know, and it's not so far off. It's not like Dallas. It's got. What am I trying to say? They understand the dramatization of it, but nothing goes off the rails in a way that doesn't make sense, and they love that it's a little bit bigger than life, you know.
Right,
and
right.
I think that's one of the reasons why politicos love House of Cards in general.
I'll tell you, the people that we pal around with who are in politics, they actually say Veep is closer to reality.
Oh, interesting. I've heard that.
Yes.
If you've ever watched
But I have. I've seen a handful of episodes, and I desperately want to be on that show. I think they do a great job. My parents are a little bit more, I mean, they got into politics believing that you can fight the good fight, and they still have faith in politics. And so for them, it's a little bit of a tough pill to swallow. House of Cards, that is. We all found it funny that I was the only person on the show who was not from DC and didn't work for anyone in DC. I was an office manager from Columbus, Ohio.
Which is why your character was one of the few redeeming characters on the show.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, there's really nobody that's, you know, there's hardly anybody there that's, you know, that you really can cheer for.
Offhand, I can't think of a single other character who is an immoral abomination in one form or another.
I think that's right, except for maybe Doug Stamper's physical therapist.
Yeah. Perhaps, yeah.
Except then they had sex and she broke all of her oaths, I'm sure. Do physical therapists have oaths? Probably
not. That was probably unethical from a physical therapy standpoint. But
exactly. Oath or not, it was unethical.
Exactly. Yeah. Which just puts you at the top of the list.
Oh man, thank you. That's what I was aiming for.
Unambiguously good characters in House of Cards.
But of course, you know, then that whole thing is flipped in terms of characters with Bill's turns. You're actually a character that has multiple families, multiple wives, and you're working for a hedge fund, and you're not exactly the most ethical finance guy. But I wanted to ask you about this, and this is.
But
this
I'm loyal. I'm loyal.
You're loyal. This is always fascinating me about acting is we get a lot of attention is given a lot of times to kind of like big dramatic scenes. Obviously, the scene where you and Damien Lewis were kind of yelling at each other, fake arguing, is great. And even the scene where Paul Giamatti's character kind of reveals that he knows about your second family, and you do the whole I'm Kaiser Soze thing at the end. But there's what fascinates me are the subtleties of acting. And so when he kind of reveals it, Bill's face kind of like, you know, like you could see in his face, he's saying, all right, he's got me. But then you kind of like there was like this little sneer that you did where you didn't say a word, but it was just a face that you made. And then you started poking on your phone like you were sending this letter to your wife, letting her know what happened. But
all right.
That kind of thing is so interesting because you're saying a lot without really saying anything. And is that something that you naturally do as the character, or are you saying, okay, I need to like, is it something you plan ahead and say, I need to do this? Or is it just something that comes out when you become Bill Stern? How does that work?
That's a good question because for me, I go back and forth, both in terms of how I think I should approach any scene, and also just how a script sort of strikes me. The fake fight scene, I didn't want to prep. I wanted to have the lines down cold so that I could do anything I wanted and not feel like I was searching for lines. But with the interrogation with Giamatti, there was a lot written because Bill doesn't talk too much. Bill's not a big talker, Dollar Bill. And so that was sort of a shock. I remember the director of the episode with the fake fight. She was like, I love that he's actually talking. He's so sort of, there's such brevity about him. And which was interesting for her to pick up on because I had noticed it as well. So I think it just sort of built that Bill was an arrogant son of a bitch. He felt superior to everyone but Axe and maybe Wags. And he didn't have to talk too much. And so a lot of the inner monologue is just, you're so beneath me. And I think that just ended up manifesting in various forms of sneering looks.
Okay.
And with Giamatti, I did plan out a few things that I ended up not really using because that dude, man, as an actor, he throws so much at you and so much different stuff at you and feeds off of every tiny little nuance that you give him back that's different, that after maybe two takes, I realized, oh, we can just play. This is just like, this is just a back and forth and he's down for it. So I don't even remember which take that was, you know. Okay. We probably shot the thing from different angles, of course, but when it was on me, we probably shot it 10 times. And there was just slightly different stuff every time. I do take cues from the script. There was something, Willie Reale wrote this script. He's on the staff again this year. And he's a producer as well. He's a great writer. And he wrote this little note, a little stage direction about what you just described. Oh shit, I know I'm caught. It wasn't those words, but it was the effect that Bill knows the jig is up. And I just tried to play with that, but he comes back so strong right. with this premeditated thing. He'd already written this note. So just I was just trying to navigate. Well, he had to know that there was some chance he'd be caught. Otherwise, he wouldn't have written this thing. He says, "I knew you'd come with that," but yet, but still, the script is telling me that he has to be somewhat, if not surprised, he has to be somewhat caught, somewhat caught. He has to be caught in some way. And I ended up what ended up feeling right was that he was saddened. You know, that there is a bit of humanity in him. He's a sociopath and he has two families, two wives, but he really likes them both. So
I think, what did you say? I try to be fair.
I try to be fair. And I think he really does. you know, Billy and I should remember this, but Billy's one of his kids and Jermaine. I don't know. little Stevie. I think he really does try to be fair. I would love the show to develop that more, like, yeah. You know, maybe a spin-off series with where you have to see Bill dealing with both families. They all had to move in together, and
it's definitely an interesting character, and, you know, interesting looking at sort of the process of acting and you know, playing off one another. For you know, our listeners who haven't had the experience, you know, can you describe what it's like to go through auditions? I understand auditions are not always fun, but are there times when they can be fun and they can be a good experience, or are they always like nerve-wracking and intensely stressful, or what?
Yes, to all that. But specifically, there are always nerves, and I get a little suspicious, both in performances, particularly on stage performances. So both in performances and for auditions, I get a little suspicious of my energy if I don't feel some nerves, if I don't feel a little bit nervous.
Mm-hmm.
The key is whether or not you can channel the energy into something interesting, as opposed to not being able to really get your breath, which happens to me periodically. I come to the end of a sentence and I realize, oh God, I'm not breathing. I'm not doing this right. And so I often start over, which you're not supposed to, from what I understand now. But I just think if you know it's not going well, you literally can't catch your breath by the end of your sentence. You're not going to get it anyway. You might as well start over. But it's... I still can't figure out how to make the audition what I like it to be. And what I like it to be is something more like a cross between a nice, casual meeting with someone. You know, if you're sitting, you've had great meetings on the subway where you're chatting with, you know, great little conversations and you're chatting and things just happen spontaneously.
Right,
a cross between that and a little mini performance where I'm enjoying I'm not showing you anything. I'm enjoying it because this is my chance to perform.
Mm-hmm.
So that in and of itself becomes valuable as opposed to it being only a means to an end. When that happens, I more often than not book the gig. But I don't know how to make that happen yet. There's still times when I go in and I'm trying to force something too hard. I'm trying to be something as opposed to channeling it. Again, that's, I know these are, it's like it's an amorphous set of terms.
Mm-hmm.
Partially because, you know, parenthetically, I sometimes feel like the biggest loser when I'm trying to explain all this stuff. And it may be because I didn't go to grad school. And I think there's a common language that actors have when they go to grad school, and it makes it easier to describe things in a more concise way.
I understand what you're saying, though. I mean, yeah. having done a little bit of theater, you know, in my earlier days, and I know what you're talking about when it clicks, you know, and when you've got the right amount of, you know, energy and the people, you've got them, you know, eating out of the palm of your hand, you know, just with little things.
Sometimes it's those little things. I mean, sometimes it's just literally that you can be the power. It's like my wife and I saw, we were seeing some comedy at Gotham Comedy Center here in New York. And all of a sudden someone announced, oh my God, Jerry Seinfeld's here. You wanted to try out some new material. And it was amazing to see this guy. And Carolyn, my wife, talked about it afterwards. She was like, he's just so easy. He's not pushing anything. There were no nerves. So he made me feel completely at ease. He wasn't asking for anything. He was delivering and he was trying shit out. And it was, even if the joke didn't work, it didn't throw him because he's trying shit out. And it's not that he doesn't care, but it's just that he's not thrown. He's not afraid. And if you could, and I think that that's the same thing. When I feel completely unafraid, still with the nervousness, so that's a bit of a, maybe that's a little oxymoronic, I suppose, but a little bit of nervousness for energy combined with a lack of fear. Like if you can bottle that, man, you're going to be the most successful actor out there. Sorry, I got off topic. What were we talking about? Oh, just the auditioning. The best and worst part of auditioning is sitting out in the lobby and waiting. And because you're out there with all these other people that are looking for the job. I found that in Los Angeles, and again, it's only my experience, in Los Angeles, it felt very much like people were constantly looking at me, looking at everyone else, like, oh, what's he got, you know? In New York, now that I have a community here, I'm often going up against a lot of my friends. And at this point, now that we're all in our 40s and we all have semblances of careers and we all like each other and we know we need each other, we know we are each other's support system, it can be kind of fun. You know, don't spread this around, but I've sometimes brought, if it's a late afternoon audition, early evening audition, I've brought my flask with me. And as soon as we're all done, we pop that out and have a little bullet bourbon and
good choice.
Talk about the choices we made. Good stuff, right?
It is very good.
Yeah, you just made it. Neil is like a nice lifelong fan now with the whole flask incident and everything. So,
are you a flask guy?
Yes, I have been known to carry a flask. In fact,
or two or three,
or actually no, it was seven. There was seven at one point. It was a dry wedding.
That's every great story starts off with. It was a dry wedding.
So I did. I had like the pouches and I had the metal flasks, you know, and so I had it and they were all over my body, like just, you know, so.
I'm going to tweet you a picture of my four flasks where they sit in the kitchen.
Yeah. So the audition process, you know, it sounds like it's much different in LA rather than New York, where it's a little, maybe you're more established, your friends are more established. And
I think that's what it is. And also the casting directors all know me now, or maybe not everybody. I'm not implying that. But, you know, I have a community here. I put in time. I've been here for 20 years. Mm-hmm. So, so I'm not casting aspersions on the Los Angeles auditioning scene. I'm just, my experience of it is much more comfortable. And that actually is a telling. That's another part of the answer. Another part of the answer to the question you asked earlier. It has to do with community. Even when I'm in a competitive situation now, the negative aspects of that are mitigated somewhat by this still being my community. And we know auditioning is a necessary evil. So we all kind of, we make the best of it, you know?
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's good though. I mean, it's nice to have that kind of community and hopefully, you know, the good thing about community, and especially in artistic fields, is that people are going to be honest with you about something instead of saying, yeah, that was great. you know, you, I don't think you hit it right or something like that.
I do think that's the case. And again, in my experience in New York, I got the sense people would be very nice, but I would get honest feedback early on. And again, I was only in my early 20s when I was in Los Angeles. And so maybe I was, who knows what factors played. But I felt like, oh, yeah, everything was beautiful. Everything was great. And then I wouldn't hear anything.
Right.
I actually, as long as it's done nicely, because I don't have a thick skin, I still would like to know where I stand. And I'd like to know so I can get better.
So, is there any, you know, I mean, I don't know if this is a question you get a lot, but is there any kind of one, is there one director that you know that's out there that you'd love to work with? Or even two, or anyone in particular? Or are you just basically saying, hey, if the material is good, I'm just going to go with who's ever, you know, who's ever doing the job?
I'm terrible at answering these questions because when people usually this is a new one actually, but it, usually the similar question is asked, like, who do you want to work with? What actor do you want to work with? And I always draw a blank when I'm trying to think. But well, this is not exactly what I think you are asking, but I'm about to work. I'm doing a workshop of a new play in October. For 2 weeks, and I'm going to be working with a director, John Rando, who I'm a big fan of, theater director. He's done lots of big Broadway musicals, and he's done some interesting off-Broadway work as well, non-musicals. And I've always wanted to work with him, so I'm getting a chance to do that. In terms of film directors, I mean, I would love to work with Clint Eastwood. Everything I hear about working with Clint Eastwood is amazing. And I was just reading this article about Sully, you know, which I haven't seen yet. Is it out or is it just in the festival?
No, I believe it's out. I saw it this past weekend. It was excellent.
Oh. Yeah, and that's what I hear. And I would love to work with the guy who talked to the empty chair. I would really love to work with a guy. And obviously people like Scorsese, and there are certain heroes out there. John Singleton is going to be directing the next episode of Billions, and I've been a fan of his for years, and I'm going to tell him this story. I was actually, when I was in LA, I was an extra on Higher Learning for about a week, one of those gigs when I was catering, you know, for the movie sets. I started off catering for this group, and we were in for the long haul when they were shooting on the UCLA campus for about a month, I think. So I was catering, and I was working with the extras, and I was talking to the guys in charge of the extras, and they told me that if I worked for 3 days at the SAG rate, I could get my SAG card. And so I ended up quitting the catering job and working as an extra on John Singleton's Higher Learning, and now I'm about to work with him on a show that I'm a, you know, a recurring character on. So I have to tell him that story. He'll be like, it won't mean anything to him, and he'll look at me strangely, I'm sure. but it means a lot to me. It feels like some sort of full circle thing. You know?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, that's a great story. I mean, I mean, he would be like, okay, well, yeah, that's terrific. Yeah. But you know, you're talking about your career and what you were doing, and now all of a sudden it's like you're working with the guy. You know? So that's really, I think that's a great story.
A lot of people make, and in every career, every business, every field, I'm sure there are stories like this, but there are people who are overnight successes. There are people who maybe not be overnight, but who hit it early or hit it mid. I guess I'm mid. But and then there are people who slog it out because they love it and they want it, and they want to get better. And maybe at a certain point, in my case, I was like, oh, I don't know what the hell else I'm going to do. So when little milestones like that happen, they mean a lot to me. Anyway, I'll tell them that story.
It's a great mark of progress, you know, so it's good to take stock of that. So
one other director I really want to work with again, Karan Kusama, who directed The Invitation, an indie movie, a great indie movie that premiered earlier this year, she directed episode 10 of Billions, which was that fake fight episode, and I really got along well with her, and I'm dying to work with her on a movie. So, Karen, if you're listening, note this. Anyway.
We'll send it to her on Twitter. let's approach the actor question that you want to work with in a different way. Is there anyone that you have worked with, an actor or an actress that you have worked with, that you absolutely had a blast working with them? You just had a great time, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, a huge number of people on stage that your audience won't know. I mean, just last summer I did a play at Manhattan Theater Club with a amazing actress named Jennifer Mudge. She and I have been friends for about 10 years, but never worked together before. And we just, she was a dream. But in terms of more well-known folk, Paul Giamatti, that scene, that interrogation scene, that was bliss. And it was interesting because we, you know, the show is two separate worlds. It's the U.S. attorney world and then the hedge fund world, and there's very little crossover. So I hadn't actually met him beyond shaking his hand at a table read, and he was so generous and open and immediately willing to just be buds for that chunk of time we were going to be working together. Like I said, I threw out all my plans. I threw my plans out the window as soon as he started two takes into him doing his thing, because I realized all I had to do was feed off of him. Mm-hmm. That was great. And I've been a huge fan of his since Donnie Brasco. If you remember Donnie Brasco,
oh, yeah.
Forget About It scene. Yeah. That was, I think he said in interviews that was his first movie role. If not first, it was certainly one of the early ones. And I remember that guy so well, just when he was trying out, you know, when...
when he's trying to say forget about it.
And he's giggling at himself for how strange it sounds. I was like, who are you? You're amazing. And then, of course, Sideways, which I bought and I listened to. I only watched the movie now with the running commentary with him and Thomas Hayden Church, because it's hysterical. If you haven't done that, you should. It's great.
Oh, that's one. I love that movie. I have to watch it with the commentary. I haven't done that.
Oh, they're hysterical. They're great. Yeah. And they're obviously so obviously like each other. And Damian Lewis, I was a fan of his since Homeland and then what's the one with Thomas More? He plays King Henry. It's a BBC series. Anyway, I'm a big fan of his, and so to get a chance to work with him in that fight scene was great. I feel lucky. I got two nice scenes last season with the two alpha males on the show who I've admired, and they not only were as great to work with as they are to watch, they were as nice as that as well. So,
mm-hmm. Well, that's great.
Now you don't have to name any names, but
how do the assholes on the set?
Yeah. are there some prima donnas that you've worked with that, like, how does that affect, you know, everybody else's performance? Can they do it and you know, give the performance that they need, or does their negative attitude or whatever, does that affect everybody else or in your?
It can. It absolutely can. People can, of course, overcome, but yes, it can. And I won't name names, but there was a show I was on reverses are, you call them reverse. There are plenty of different names for them, but I'm acting with you. The camera's on you over my shoulder, and I'm acting. I'm giving you a performance so that you can. While the camera's on you, you can give a performance based
right.
on the I'm going to be giving you. Then the camera turns around and goes over your shoulder onto me for the reverse. And you stick around, and you give me the lines, and you give me the performance, and we create the scene that way, and there's continuity. But there was a show I did. It was one of my early – I'm not going to say that. I don't want to –
make it easy for people to figure out who it is.
You know, I'm already at your Wikipedia page. I'm kind of like,
who could this be?
Who was it?
But there was they didn't stick around, and there was somebody who was in charge of continuity and making sure that your lines. If you screw up a line, they'll come up and tell you. And maybe if you moved your hand this way on that line, you have to do that now. And so that person was standing in the vacated spot. But this lovely woman who was trying to do it also didn't know the line. So she was in the page. She wasn't looking. She didn't make eye contact. And the other lead actor who didn't leave, who wasn't even... he was one of the two people I was looking at. He finally said, "Yeah, this is ridiculous. He has to be able to look someone in the eye." So he stepped in and gave this other actor's lines. Somehow he had memorized, so that I could have someone who was a real actor, and I could look in someone's eyes, and he would react and whatever. It was just such a wonderful, gracious. And I want to name him because he was so over the top great. But I can't, because then it'll make
I don't like to
call anybody out. Everybody has their reasons. I'm sure there were reasons, but it was, you know, that kind of thing becomes difficult. And I had a couple of the producer people apologize for it, so I knew that it wasn't just me being overly sensitive. It was something that wasn't necessarily cool. So anyway, that's the type of thing that can happen, and it does affect people, or just a negative energy where people are running scared. That's not conducive to creativity. Like, especially if you have no rehearsal time, which you don't in TV. The key is, like, the things you need to be well slept, and you need to feel like you can do anything, you know? You have to be able to with lack of rehearsal in particular, spontaneity, and a room where it's safe to fail is absolutely key. So if you have someone who has an energy that is not conducive to that, then it damages the chances of the show to be good. And on both Billions and The Americans and on House of Cards, Michael Kelly on House of Cards played I played his brother, Doug. He's Doug Stamper. Mike, he's so great, and he's such a sweetheart. He's the nicest guy in the world.
I saw him in another role where he wasn't Doug Stamper, and I was like, "What? Wait,
he is completely
just threw me completely.
Yeah,
it just shows you what a good actor he is, you know.
Yeah, and so all three of those shows, from executive producers who are sometimes on the set to the directors they use. To the first ADs, to the second ADs, to the PAs, to the camera people, to the actors. All three of these shows are so they're so community oriented. They're so supportive and rigid. You know that you got to do your work, but they're so open to whatever you bring, and that's great. And I was just shooting this new show, ABC show called Conviction, up in Toronto. It's going to start airing in October, and I just did one episode. And I was lucky enough, again, to have the same kind of thing, where people are just there. And not just there, that makes it sound like they're not doing anything, but they're just open to what you bring. And they'll feed off of it. I'm very fortunate. It's not always like that.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, you know, and again, this is a thing that's interesting too. I think you'd probably agree, and let me know if you disagree. Is obviously the progression of television and how good it's become. I mean, if you go back 30 years to TV, you know, it's like the only people that would like were former movie stars that would appear on TV were. People that would go like on The Love Boat or Fantasy Island or something like
right,
that.
Right, right.
And now you have established cinematic, you know, maybe not superstars, but people that are well known, like Kevin Bacon or something like that, or Glenn Close when she was on The Shield, you know, going and actively seeking out television roles, whether it's, you know, cable or regular television. And so is that, I mean, obviously, has that helped you to be able to, because there are these wonderful television shows that everybody's producing these days with such great writing. I mean, some of the best writing, I swear, is on television these days, without a doubt. And so, yeah. I mean, how does that overall, I mean, even in looking into the future, do you feel like because of that, you know, things are a little bit brighter for you?
I'm sorry, when you talked about Love Boat and I was thinking Fantasy Island, I was thinking Barbie Benton.
yeah.
It was like my early crush. Sorry, I got thrown.
You had the poster on the wall?
No, I completely agree. And luckily for a lot of us who stuck it out as New York theater actors, there's a ton of the great stuff that shoots in New York. It's wonderful writing, and I think it's probably not a coincidence that a lot of these shows shoot, well, Stranger Things was only 8 episodes, but generally 10 to 13 episodes. It's closer to that British model than the classic American model of 20 plus per season. It's probably easier to keep up the quality when you don't have to have quite as long a season. Not that there aren't shows that shoot, you know, the longer amount that are great. It definitely benefits me. What has benefited me, is I think in a lot of ways, again, having hit older, is that a lot of these shows don't have to reach quite the audience that they used to. So I don't necessarily, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but part of one of my many theories is that I don't necessarily have to be the 25-year-old hot guy. I can be the 40-ish bald guy, you know, and there are interesting roles to be had because they don't have to necessarily reach quite, it can be a niche show. Billions
you're not talking
is a
about,
big hit,
yeah,
but,
you're
it's,
not about
but it's
reaching
not like,
a particular.
Oh, sorry,
no, I was going to say, you're not, there's not a producer that's worried, you know, people that are sitting there looking at the ratings and worrying about what demo you're hitting or something like that. So because it's,
and there probably are, but my understanding is that it's just not as, it's not as dire, or the demo, you know, the audience doesn't have to be as big.
Right.
I was about to say something that was probably devastatingly interesting, but, but it, you know, it's nice that older people who look like real people, you know, people like me, can find interesting roles now. And I think it's not always the case, but I think it's more the case now than it was before. It's harder, interestingly, with all the shows out there, it's actually harder to break a certain ceiling in terms of pay. Than it used to be. They call it top of show. There's a minimum. Minimum amount you'll make for a week's work, and it's hard to break top of show now. Harder than it used to be, which is sort of interesting. It was surprising to me because I would think with all the shows out there, there's not like there are that many more actors. So I would have thought, just in terms of labor management dynamics, that we would have more bargaining power than we used to, but doesn't necessarily seem to be the case. And it may be because there are more big stars that do TV, and they got to get paid because they're bringing in ratings. So maybe that's part of it too.
Well, maybe chase them out or something. You know, so go back to the.
Right.
Go back to the.
That's right.
Go back to the big screen.
I'm thrilled and I'm really lucky because I've got the two. I've got Americans and Billions, and they only overlap for a couple months a year. So there's only about 2 months where the first and second ADs are pissed off at me because they're having to work around my schedule. So I have like 9 months, which is normally. I mean, I'm knocking wood because I don't know what's going to happen with either of the characters. But in recent years, I've had 9 months of work, which is the sort of classic length of the length of the classic shows. So, and then I can have 3 months to do a play, which has happened, which is, I've been lucky too, because I love theater and would never want to give that up.
All right. Okay. Well,
Kelly,
yeah.
Thank you so much for your time. You know, we really appreciated the chance to talk to you and learn a little bit more about the craft, And and it is just really interesting to get a glimpse into that world. Now at the top of the show we said we don't do any gotcha questions, but that was a bit of a lie. We do have one.
Okay.
And
the answer is Barbie Benton. Sorry.
The answer is always Barbie Benton. No, the gotcha question that we have, it's an important cultural issue. But I just want to assure you that no matter how you choose to answer this question, it will not affect our opinion of you in any way. We will still hold you in the same high regard. So, Jay.
All right. As you can hear, there's some Beethoven playing in the background here, and this is the music that appeared in the movie Die Hard. And so the ultimate question here, Kelly, is this. Very simple. Is Die Hard a Christmas movie?
Oh, solid question. Before I answer that question, I'm going to say Alan Rickman is one of the actors I absolutely would have loved to have performed with. That guy was great.
He was.
First time I ever saw him was in a movie called Truly Madly Deeply, which was so different from his Hans Gruber character.
Absolutely.
Everyone should watch that. So is it a Christmas movie? I'm going to go with yes.
Yes.
Yes, yes it is. Yes it is.
Poor Neil.
I'm getting blown out of the water here on this question. This is worse than the Frank Sinatra versus Dean Martin question we had.
I'm going with Dean Martin on that one.
Oh, see? There, he's then now you made Neil happy.
Okay,
that's probably because it's probably related to the whole flask thing and all that kind of stuff too.
It is
too,
the
so.
Flask thing.
Yeah. Oh, can I tell you an interesting little bit about flasks?
Jeez. Go right ahead.
You kick me off the air whenever you need to.
No, go.
I always have the flask in my bag, so at the end of any shooting day when we're all taken to Van home, I always pop out the flask, which makes me popular on the set. But there were times when the writing staff was also in the van going back with us, and so they saw this. So when the funeral episode of Billions was written, I don't know if you remember, there was a scene when Dollar Bill pulls out a flask and then passes it down the line. When I first got that script, I was convinced that they wrote it because enough writers had been in the van with me when I pulled my flask out. I have no idea if that's true, but I like to think that I somehow affected the
writers. Did you get to use your own flask in the scene?
No, but I stole the flask from the staff. Because I had two at the time, one of which my wife gave me with a K plus C moniker on it, which was adorable. But they both had leaks, so I stole that one. And sorry to the props person if they're listening to this right now.
That's great. All right, well, Kelly O'Coin, thank you so much. And everybody's out there watching. You know, if you're not a Showtime subscriber, you should. And there's an easy way to do that. If you're at Amazon Prime, you can get Showtime for like $8 a month. And then you can watch Billions. And, of course, The Americans is, you can go and watch that. Go binge watch those things. They're great stuff. Kelly, thanks again.
Thank you, guys. This is really a pleasure.
Yeah.
Thanks.
It was our pleasure as well. And as we say, go out there. If you like the podcast, go out there and subscribe. Leave us a rating. And I'm Jay Caruso for Neil Dewing. We'll see you next time here on The Fifth Estate.